Welkie, welkie, comrades. It's been a very long time between podcasts. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that this podcast is recorded on stolen land, the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty was never ceded. The struggles for self-determination continue. Invasion, exploitation, and oppression are ongoing systems. And one of the sites of racist oppression in Australia today is our carceral system, our prisons, our courts, the society at large, policing. And that's what this podcast is about today. A little while ago, I was really lucky to have a conversation with Marley Rabel, an academic, researcher, activist, and downright legend who has a comprehensive knowledge of carceral systems and their history. We talk about crime and punishment. We talk about the history of prisons, the economics of prisons, the sociology of prisons, and we talk about alternative models of justice that aren't about retribution. We also chat about the Zapatistas, the autonomous anti-capitalist movement in southern Mexico, which has been fighting for over 20 years now, and Marley actually visited as an international observer. So there's a lot of really cool stuff in here, both theory and practice, and I learned heaps. A little heads up that there is some pretty intense discussions at some point about crime. We don't go into too much gory detail, but there's definitely some stuff that might disturb people. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. I am the Ben of Bensplaining, and I wish you a very warm welkie welkie. Welkie, welkie, Marley.
Thank you, Ben.
You don't have to say welkie, welkie back. Though maybe that should be a policy I should implement.
I think I'll stick with hello, hello.
Whereabouts are you from?
Well, I'm from Washington State, is where I grew up in the United States. So I have come to Australia to pursue a project that has been sort of in the making for a number of years now. The project is sort of a global exploration of justice systems. When I say global, though, that sounds a little glorious for what it probably actually is, in the sense that unfortunately, many things are limited by funding, so I will, at least for now, be going to Australia and Argentina to look at their justice systems, and hopefully, though, I will be able to go further. And the goal is different for each country, but the general idea, I guess the overarching idea, is that I was noticing in the work that I've done in Washington State that it didn't feel like there was much opportunity for people to be looking across country borders, I guess, when it came to justice systems. I did some research in Nicaragua on their rural mediation practices, and kind of from the moment that I did that, I was like, wow, there's this whole world out there where there's all these different like programs and practices and, you know, alternatives and things like that that are happening that I don't even know about, and I bet you a lot of people in the U.S. don't know about. Why am I here in Australia specifically? Yes. When I originally envisioned this trip, I was going to begin in England, a country with some of the oldest sort of like penitentiary models, okay. And then I wanted to sort of trace that down to Australia,
yes,
in terms of Australia being a penal colony.
Well, that's it. We are England's biggest prison. So it makes sense that this is where you're going.
Yeah. And at first, like, that was what I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And that's what got me interested in even like looking at Australia in the first place. But then, I mean, very quickly, I came across the incredibly appalling statistic that was that, you know, 3% of the population of Australia, basically, I'm not sure if this is actually Australia or this might be the Northern Territory, but is you know, indigenous people, but
that's
then,
yeah, that's Australia as a whole.
Okay, Australia as a whole. And then it's something like 30% of the prison population is indigenous people. And so that's like, that's unreal.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of representation.
It's obscene.
And since I've also, you know, done a fair bit of like reading and work with how race is working in the US justice system, as in not working at all, I thought that that would be a really good place to try to maybe draw some comparisons and like see what's going on, because you can't just have countries that incarcerate, you know, minorities at these ridiculous rates and just be like, oh, well, it's just random. At least to me as a yes. sociologist, yes. like it does not seem random. And so I was like, maybe there are some comparisons that can be drawn, and also maybe there are some like major differences that will, you know, come out of the woodwork, because, you know, in the US it's African Americans that are yeah. our highest incarcerated, but here it's indigenous peoples, and so it's actually been interesting. I've been here only a month, but I think I'm starting to like see a little bit, you know, why this might be a little different. Like, but at the same time, I mean, we incarcerate also like after African Americans, it's like Hispanic people and then indigenous people, you know. Yeah. So it is like
so the what same. What are the similarities and differences you've observed in your research and interviews?
Well, I think one big similarity that you can't miss is just the fact that both of these countries are settler colonialist
yes.
Areas. And I mean, that means a huge amount in terms of what our prisons look like. In terms of Australia, I feel like I'm starting to understand through, I had an amazing conversation with Charndev Singh, who was talking to me about, you know, from the moment that Australia was colonized, people have been incarcerated.
Yes.
And so that's much beyond just the walls of a prison compound. That's in reservations, right?
Yes.
That's in... like,
missions.
Yeah, missions and just all sorts of things that maybe aren't thought of as traditional prisons. But when one lays it out to you kind of like that, it really felt, it really struck me as a true policy, I guess, since the moment of colonization, that it's just been like... very traumatic, and the idea has been to both incarcerate and exterminate like the first peoples of Australia. And then because in the US, then you go and you look at the US and our history as like a, you know, slave nation kind of thing, in the sense that I don't know, have you read the book The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander?
No, I haven't. I've heard it's excellent. I've seen The 13th on Netflix.
Ah, sure, sure. Yeah, so basically, but that's where I was going to go with it. It's just like talking about how, I mean, you start with slavery, and that's how you have cheap labor, right? And then the next wave of that is now, you know, prisons in terms of the U.S. And, I mean, to me, that also relates to the labor, but it's also hugely... connected to race and just trying to constantly have a way to like control different bodies, I guess.
I read a little about that in Angela Davis's book, Our Prisons Obsolete. Loved it. She's incredible. It just astonished me looking at those statistics, the way that it seems like it's an almost seamless continuation of slavery and then segregation, Jim Crow policies and indentured labor and all of those things. And how there's just this constantly rightsless proportion
yeah.
of the African-American population.
Yeah, yeah. It's like time after time, people are like, it's over, it's over, it's over, you know, like racism is done.
Yeah.
And time after time, it's like, no, it's just moved into a different realm.
Yes.
You know? So I'm actually interested to see what will happen if we ever can get over mass incarceration, which, you know, seeing the way we're headed, I'm not really sure how, where that's going to go, but where will it move next?
Yeah.
You know, where will it move next? Because it sure seems like we haven't broken the mold yet.
So what does mass incarceration look like? Because I know incarceration rates are higher.
Mm-hmm. I mean, mass incarceration is like, okay, so incarceration rates aren't just higher in the U.S. We're yes. like the number one in the world by leaps and bounds in terms of the number of people that we incarcerate. So I can't tell you specific statistics because, once again, I'm just like really bad at pulling those out generally. But like, you know, if you look at charts, and this is even like taking, you know, countries per capita kind of yes. thing, it's like, we're just way off the charts in terms of the amount of people that we're incarcerating compared to, you know, population. In fact, I don't know if I should even say, but it's something like 1 in 18 families now have someone in their family who has been incarcerated. And it's something like 1 in 3 males, African-American males between the ages of 18 and 25 will be incarcerated in their lifetime. So, you know, when we're talking about mass incarceration, we're talking about, you could have 3 people like sitting in this room.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I guess we're in Australia, but you know, yeah. in the US, if you had 3 black men between those ages sitting in the room, one of them would have a life outcome expectancy of like being incarcerated. For me, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
In terms of,
because
yeah.
even if people don't receive actual life sentences, it's still a life sentence because mm-hmm. there's so much deliberate stigma.
Yeah.
As well as the psychological trauma of being in that environment.
There's so much that prison does that people don't necessarily think about, even beyond just the incarceration bit. You know, it breaks up families, it makes it so it's very hard for people to find housing and jobs, especially in the US. I'm not actually sure yet about these things in Australia. I've heard that it might be a little bit better here, in terms of like
probably not all that much though.
I would guess not all that much, but maybe there's been some sort of like, the people that I've talked to, I think like people can try to, you know, make it seem like it's kind of okay. But I mean, it is particularly bad though in the US, especially because we just have so many people too going through the system. When people get out of prison in the US, generally, if they're lucky, they're given maybe enough money for a bus ticket and a hotel room.
What?
And that's all. They're just let out the gates, and that's what it is.
So there's no programs to reintegrate people into society, or...
Well, so there are some, but, like, the ones that are run by the government are extremely... They're just over... They're inundated, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I actually worked for one of the few programs. It was a nonprofit in Walla Walla, Washington, called the Star Project, which is
Walla Walla, Washington.
Yes, that's where I went to school. Sounds like an Australian town. It is an Australian town.
Really?
Yeah, it is. It is. I was told this by someone who used to live there. Yeah, but it is also a place in the U.S.
A Washingtonian town.
Sure, a Washingtonian town. But yeah, so this was a nonprofit in Walla Walla that worked on that reentry side of people coming out of prison, but it was a very uncommon sort of organization to find, because it just is not that common for these things to exist outside of the realm of like government funding. And, it was a really great program, but it was also like, it didn't actually put that many people like through. It couldn't serve that many people, just like most of the other programs. So
yeah, so it sounds like there's a total lack of support, or a substantial lack of support for people out of the prison system, which I guess begs the question, surely that does that feed into crime rates? Like
I see what you're saying.
So it sounds like there's not even a, and I think that we have the same issue to some extent in Australia, when you have these increasingly punitive models of, you know, lock them up or whatever, and people are always really happy to have funding cuts of prison education programs, and that sort of thing. What are the ramifications of that?
Yeah, I feel like if you are cutting all of the potentially positive things that could maybe influence someone to do something differently. This is the thing. I feel like people have this concept of prisons as, like, not only a place that people go for punishment, but, like, the general idea is, like, ah, they will go there for punishment and they will also change their ways.
Yes.
Right? But this is the problem. If you don't have education systems, if you don't have programming, if you don't have things that make people feel like they have some sort of human dignity, then how can you expect someone to change their behavior? And then second of all, if you are giving them absolutely no support, you just like drop them off the edge of a cliff basically when they're getting out of prison, it is very unsurprising that you have extremely high recidivism rate, right? And I've heard actually that in Australia at the moment, especially Victoria, that's a huge problem, is that the recidivism rates have been off the wall in terms of like going up and up and up instead of down, which is, you know, what you want to generally see. So I know that that's also an issue here. But I mean, yeah, that's sort of my personal take on it too, is like, a lot of people don't quite, like, you there's this whole rhetoric around, like, lock them up and, you know, throw away the keys and take away all the money, like, you shouldn't have cushy living, right, and things like that. But to me, the idea is very, very different, because if you want to actually treat these people as, you know, human beings, and if you, you know, 90% of these people are coming back out from prisons. I think that's another thing that people don't understand, is like, in the US, a lot of people think, I'm not sure here, but a lot of people think that, like, well, like, once someone goes to prison, they're going to be gone forever. And there are a lot of life sentences. But the reality is that 90% of people are going to get out. And so if you're not, if we're not, like, providing for that, and thinking about how prison is actually going to affect someone, and you know, trying to make like changes for people, there's no way, at least in my mind, that you could expect someone to make a positive change.
I remember reading in an article that was talking about Norway's prison system, where there's counseling for every inmate, there's extensive recreation, I think there's like private quarters if people want them, while also having, you know, opportunities for hobbies and like heaps of sport and that sort of thing. And like the recidivism rate was a quarter of the US's.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's another reason I was interested. I was kind of just interested to go somewhere like Scandinavia, sort of like whatnot. But we had a woman come and talk to us when I went to Whitman College. Who was talking about open prisons.
Open prisons? What are open prisons?
Yeah, open prisons. This is something where you, the people who are incarcerated there basically can choose to leave or come or go from the prison. It's but you have to, there are like certain guidelines, and you have to, you know, carry out a portion of your sentence in, you know, within the prison walls. But it's much more flexible in terms of like, people have for example, people have family crises, right? Like, say someone in the family is sick.
Yes.
If you're incarcerated in the U.S., I've talked to multiple people and, you know, heard countless more stories where, you know, they're in prison and their mom or dad dies and they never got to say anything to them, you know, because their request to go to that, go to their deathbed or go to that funeral even is denied. It's just flat out denied. Whereas like something like the open prison can account for a lot of those things. You know, if you need to be home for some reason, it is allowed for you to go and like take care of these sort of like family things or still be a part of your family. And stuff. So I don't actually know a whole heck of a lot about it, but it sure is a different concept than what most people are used to for prisons, right? So yeah, there's a lot of different models happening, especially in Scandinavia, that seem to be the outcomes seem to be pretty good for prisons. I would also argue, though, like having begun this trip, that there's a lot to the history of a place that seems important for their prisons. And so I don't know a whole lot about like the history of Denmark or Norway and whatnot, but I think that it's a pretty different history in terms of like colonialism and whatnot.
Right. Yes.
And I think that that has a big difference, like, and racism, you know, and the type of society, like, it's a pretty homogenous society, right, in both Denmark and Norway, to some extent, like.
I think so. But yeah, also I guess the fact that these countries are comparatively functioning social democracies with education systems and health systems.
Yeah.
And social safety nets in place.
Right. Well, and see, that's what I would have said, actually, like, 1 month ago, too. So I do think that that's really important,
yes,
right? Like, obviously, if you have a country that is taking care of people's, like, social needs and actually addressing things on what I would call is, like, the front end, if you take care of people's needs, like, give them housing, give them work, take care of healthcare, take care of, like, education and stuff, you're going to already see a massive decrease in the amount of people going to prison. But I also just think that it does have to do with these sort of, like, looking now at Australia and the US, I mean, just there's these massive issues around racism and, you know, taking over lands and things like that that still contribute today to the carceral system, you know, that's what feeds into the system. And so that also feels like an important aspect that I don't think I would have picked up on, like, necessarily in the way that I am right now.
And Australia has such a horrific and recent and ongoing history of dispossession and oppression.
Yeah.
The deaths in custody rate for Aboriginal people is horrific. Have you looked into that at all?
It is horrific. I was reading the report on the Aboriginal, you know, deaths in custody, and it's actually not comparatively more deaths of Aboriginal people in custody. But the problem is that your representation, right, is so high of this population that of the people who are dying, I mean, it's a huge amount,
yes,
are, you know, Indigenous people. Marissa from the Do In Time show at 3CR was saying also that we should call them murders in custody, right? Because if you're talking about an institution that is supposed to be taking care of someone's, like, livelihood, I call them, these are, like, supposedly total institutions, right? Which means that the institution is taking care of every need, basically, of that person. It's encompassing that person's life as a whole. So we're talking about prisons, asylums. There's a lot of other things that I could argue are total institutions. But to me, it's like, okay, there is a extreme responsibility of that institution to take care of people's mental and physical health. And that has been extremely in both places that I've looked at, which is the US and Australia, you know, ignored to a high extent. You know, people's health complaints are not taken seriously. And that's a huge factor that goes into people dying and being murdered in custody, because these are deaths that are preventable. Generally, if you were not incarcerated, if this person was not incarcerated, they would not have died. You know, it's a facilitated killing.
Yeah.
When you are supposed to be responsible for those lives as an institution. So to me, that's just inexcusable.
So what about, I'm sure a lot of people would say, right? Whoa. Hold your horses. These aren't little innocent cherubs we're talking about. These are people who have broken the social contract. These are people who have killed and stolen and, you know, maybe some don't deserve to be in there as much as others. But, you know, why should we be rolling out the red carpet for these people and providing them with these fantastic services when, you know, these are the people who are doing social harm? What about the victims? What about the victims, Marley?
What about the victims? Well, I mean, first of all, of course, like, victims have a huge, like, say in terms of, like, there should be just as many programs and resources going into, you know, ensuring, say, like, mental health and counseling and grief services and things like that for people who are victims. Like, I am not arguing that, like, you should be, like, you know, victims, who cares, right? That is not. But at the same time, like, I come at this from a point of view that, like, look, these are people who are a part of our society and will continue to be a part of our society. Even if you have committed some sort of, I guess, crime against society or crime against individual whatnot, and that you can't just write off those lives as being worthless, because that is completely inhumane and undignified and does not acknowledge these people as human beings. And it also does not acknowledge that there are many systems in place that funnel certain groups and people into the carceral system that would end up there that, you know, other people would not. I mean, one thing that one of my, you know, mentors at the STAR Project, Glenna Aubrey, used to say was just kind of like, any of us could be criminals at any point, kind of thing. Like, if you were constantly watched all the time, like, the line is actually, you know, quite thin in some senses for criminality. I mean, like, people jaywalk all the time, for example. Or just, you might, like, litter, right? Or you might, like, hop onto a tram and not, like, have your card filled up. Just, like, things like that. And, okay, like, maybe someone could be like, oh, but that's not the murderers or something like that. Well, like, the thing is that, like, that there's so much social stuff that's involved with, like, why people commit crimes, at least in my mind. I mean, there's so much that has to do with, like, poverty or, like, violence, right, that has maybe even been committed against these people in their lifetime. There's homelessness and, I don't know, like, the list could go on and on.
Well, and I suppose intergenerational poverty and suffering from these systems.
Because absolutely.
Even if people have throw them away and lock away the key, you know, which really doesn't make sense unless you're going to do that for every single crime. You're going to get a life or death sentence to any prisonable offense. That you're still depriving, you know, a lot of those people have children who are getting deprived of a parent.
Sure. This is really, that's a really good point.
And it seems to me that given that we know that more punitive, more brutal, less rehabilitation-based systems of incarceration, we know that that perpetuates crime. We know that drives up recidivism. So really, people have a choice between punishing criminals and reducing crime. And I think that by choosing to prioritize like revenge fantasies, which are kind of often layered, and I'm not talking about victims here, I'm talking about the, people like me and people who would vote for, these policies that are often layered with, these kind of racist and classist undertones. It actually increases crime, and what keeps crime happening. And that's without even talking about the actual trauma and suffering that's inflicted by these institutions. Sorry, that's just me ranting. Do you know the name of the podcast, by the way?
Which one?
This one.
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
I don't remember right
It's
now.
Bensplaining.
Oh,
And that's why, because sometimes I'm just like, blah, 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 blah. Even though you're an incredible expert, so I'm sorry.
I think you've done very little bensplaining. I feel like it's been contributions.
Oh, thank you. You haven't heard the edited version yet. Well, so what's the history of prisons? Because we've always had prisons, haven't we? I've always been.
No,
No?
no. I was like, for a second, I was like, wait, what?
I was using a rhetorical device to
Yeah,
drive the
thank you.
conversation forward.
I was apparently pretending to be listening now. Because we've always had prisons. Yeah, no, this is a good question. Yeah, so no, we haven't always had prisons. Though, now that I'm thinking about it, like on a wider scale, I mean, there's been a lot of like forms of incarceration, like what I was touching on with, like, for example, yeah, reservations, right? Or what was the one that you, the example you came up with? It's like,
Missions,
yeah, sorry, reservations, missions, things like that, that have just been there for a very long time. But the modern, like, penitentiary system sort of thing, where you have these built, very specifically built environments for like carceral needs, is a pretty recent invention. In fact, within the last like few hundred years. And most people think that prisons are, there's no other option other than prisons. Like,
Yes.
of course you need to lock away people. Of course you like need to do this or that. But if you look in recent history, that wasn't really the case. Now we are talking about like a lot of what would happen. So punishment generally would be carried out against the body rather than, and this is a very like Foucaultian argument, but like, you know,
Foucault being a very famous French sociologist. Sort
sociologists
of.
and many other
I mean,
things,
nothing.
But the yeah, so the punishment has sort of moved from the body, which includes things like you steal this loaf of bread, you lose a hand, or you work on a chain gang, right? Like that's a was another really big thing, was just like forced labor. Not that that isn't a thing these days, but then things started moving over. I can't pull out the dates for you. I want to say like late 1700s, but that's just like a kind of a shot in the dark. From this sort of very violent spectacle-based carcerality to kind of like behind hidden doors, and it was much more about like reforming people's souls and you know, how was that going to take place?
So that sounds like that is kind of a humane idea.
Well, the original idea of the penitentiary was about, yeah, penitence, and was a religious sort of pursuit, in terms of like, you know, supposed to be sort of a reflective solitude that people would come to understand their sins.
I like to imagine if I was ever in prison, I'd meditate 8 hours a day and reach enlightenment and pen some really beautiful novels.
Sure.
I probably wouldn't happen, would it?
Probably not. You might pen some beautiful novels on the wall. As you count the days. Wow, that's pretty morbid. But anyways, yeah. I guess I would like to dispel the myth of the fact that, like, there have always been prisons, there will always be prisons, because there always were prisons. That argument just doesn't quite work for me because, you know, prisons are a pretty modern invention in the way that we, you know, think about them generally today.
Yeah, and it sounds like there's... So this is just me completely making shit up. But it sounds like there's this shift from a kind of physical to psychological retribution.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's like as society kind of has kind of more of an inward turn, first with kind of like, you know, Protestant work ethic and looking for, you know, Calvinism, being like, you know, are you saved inside? And then, you know, the Quakers and all meditation and that kind of thing coming. And then psychoanalysis later on in the late 19th century, that there's, it then becomes this kind of prison becomes like a state of mind that's facilitated by this environment of like supreme shame and guilt, rather than just like, you know, whipping you or something.
Sure. Well, and another thing too is that, I mean, I feel like I have to mention because we're going down this path, but so I mentioned before that, like, not only was punishment before about sort of the body, right? It was all eyes on the person being punished, kind of thing. It was a spectacle, right? Well, now it's much more about, like, if you think about sort of the panopticon, right? Now we've switched.
What's the panopticon for those who?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about like the physical, basically the panopticon is like, as a prison, it's a physical structure where you have a circular prison where there's a guard tower in the middle. And the idea is that you're always being watched, but you don't know when you're being watched, kind of thing. Because the guard tower has like darkened windows and whatnot. And so the idea is that you basically self-survey because you never know when you're actually being watched. And that's...
And wasn't that founded by Jeremy Bentham?
Yeah, I think it was.
Who was the father of utilitarianism in public policy.
Yeah.
With the view of, like, how can we do the most amount of good with maximum efficiency? So how can we pay the least to police all of these prisoners?
right. Yeah, and, like, so, well, and this is the thing, too, is, like, if you look at this sort of topic and the way that things are going in terms of surveillance, the idea is to get more and more people to be kind of like watching each other instead of taking your eyes and like looking at the spectacle. It's using your eyes and like watching all the other people kind of around you. And so like that's what our society is becoming. I mean, that's what I would argue kind of with the police too, is that the police is kind of like this parent figure almost.
And yes.
People will call the police as this sort of tertiary involvement for like quarrels they have with their neighbors, right? And I'm not saying that it's like, you know, don't call the police if there's like domestic violence or something like that. But I'm just saying that a lot of times, like, the police are employed as this like sort of mechanism in which other people are surveilling, like they're doing the surveillance, like we're all surveying each other. And then like the cops get called as this sort of parental like third involvement. Well, like if you don't do this, I'm going to call the cops kind of thing.
Yeah. I'll get mom.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, wow, I'm getting into like so many different things, but just, I mean, for me, this also has a lot to do with kind of this thing that I feel like is happening in communities where people no longer know how to address conflict within communities very well, without like the involvement of something like the police,
An authority with
sure.
license to use violence
yeah.
of some kind.
Yeah,
thing.
And like in the US we love to be like, I'm going to sue you, yeah. right? Like, like that's another big thing. I'm going to yeah. call the police, I'm going to sue you. Like, it's always about like getting this like formal system of justice involved.
Yes.
Whereas like, maybe this was influenced a lot by the stuff that I did in Nicaragua. I mean, I was living in a rural community where, I mean, no one could afford the money that it would take to even go to the police station. And so conflict in these communities, for a long time actually, was kind of being carried out in terms of just like violent acts that would kind of go back and forth as people would feud. But now there's these mediation processes, which involves someone who's called a rural judicial facilitator, who in these rural communities is sort of that person that you can call upon.
Yes.
But they're not, if you can come upon an agreement kind of thing between the two parties that have come to the mediation table, then, you know, that's the agreement. And you don't have to go to court, you don't have to go to the police, things like that. Like, it all happens within your own community. And to me, I like that model and thinking of like being able to solve conflicts and problems within your community, right? And addressing that on sort of a human to human level.
It's a way that's not zero sum.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way that's all about the context,
mm-hmm.
rather than about basis, like appealing to a kind of concrete set of
yeah.
divinely inspired laws that are enforced by the state's monopoly on violence.
Yeah, yeah. And there's, yeah, I mean, and I don't necessarily agree with like everything that has to do with mediation, but it sure as heck seems like one solution that's being had in places that seems to be working a lot better than like police and policing and formal court.
What do you do about those cases where there are really horrendous crimes?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
murders or child abuse or sexual violence or
yeah.
domestic violence, as you said.
Yeah,
like because yeah, it's I don't know, when it's abstract, it's easier, but then when there's the emotions of thinking about the actual crimes get in there, it can feel less clear, even though I don't think it is.
Yeah. I mean, this is a hard I get this question all the time
yeah.
from people, and I'm still not, like, that great at answering it. I think, like, maybe because there's something very fundamental about, like, it doesn't really matter what the crime was, because it's still, like, a human being that you're dealing with in terms of like human being or human beings, right?
Mm.
That were the people who, you know, committed this crime. And I just don't, I think that for me, on based on my, you know, set of beliefs and whatnot, that just because someone does something that may be horrendous and terrible and like affect a lot of people doesn't mean that their life also has to like be taken away and sacrificed and become something like horrible and miserable
yes.
and terrible.
It doesn't help anyone.
It yeah. Yeah, that's, and like I think I might have mentioned this to you, but like I was working with the Washington Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
Yes.
In Washington State. And we had a lot of victims' family members who were in support of abolishing the death penalty.
Really?
Yeah, and a lot of people didn't know that that was the case, right? Because you'd think that like these family members would just be so hurt and torn up that, you know, they want this retributive justice sort of thing and like death to you. But a lot of these family members were just like wanted to be able to sort of deal with their grief and move on and not have to go through these, you know, decades-long court processes and yeah, so there was actually a lot of support. No, I'm not saying like all the time, but you know, that's the thing about thinking about victims too in crimes. You have to talk with victims and see like what do they want and feel and things like that. And I mean, you get people with emotions all across the board, right? In terms of these things. And so to just always assume that, you know, the victims of course want this person to like rot in hell is not really reasonable. And so I'm getting off the
topic. Absolutely again, like but... one of my favorite stories I might have told you is this guy from US, Hector Black, whose daughter was murdered and in these like quite really awful circumstances. And he was like this elderly man, and there's like footage of when the victims all had so her relatives all had a chance to speak to the guy when he was being sentenced. And they all, you know, say you should rot in hell or so and so, and he's just stony faced, and the father gets up and says, so he's a Christian, he says, you've made it really hard for me to be a Christian, and you know, you've taken a really wonderful person out of the world, but I know what she'd want and I forgive you. And the perpetrator bursts into tears, and they actually formed a relationship which I think is still ongoing. And the perpetrator ended up opening up to this man, Hector Black, about all the abuse he'd experienced as a child and seeing his sister drowned by a parent when he was 6 years old. Probably put a content note on the front of this little one, shouldn't
I? Yeah, potentially.
Yeah, shit. Might edit that out. Sorry. But the courage of that humanity was just inspiring to me. And obviously that's a rare case, but it's still like...
It's not as rare necessarily as you would think. There's a little clip, not even like a little clip, but it's a film online called Meeting with a Killer, which is about that sort of process too of someone going through meeting face to face with the person who killed, I think it was her sister. Going through this series of really, really hard, you know, meetings with this man, but you know, in order to try to find some sense of questions being answered, right, and humanity, I think, within it all. And so that's actually another practice that's I'm not remembering the exact name that they call this by, but it's victim offender meetings,
and which is obviously not going to be appropriate in every
not going to be appropriate in every case, but and these are always victim requested.
Yes, of course.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. And so, but they've been really powerful in many cases, and it's another example for me, at least, of, you know, crime is, and you know, horrific violent crime is something that is really hard to deal with, I think, on all ends. But there is more than one way than just locking someone up and throwing away the key. And you don't always know, just from like basic gut intuition, what a victim is going to want.
And I suppose I've read and spoken to people who have been, you know, survivors of sexual violence, for instance, for whom the justice system and experience of going through the justice system was actually a continuation of the trauma.
Oh yeah.
And in some cases even more traumatic than
that. Right. I had that too in terms of, you know, people I've known. Yeah, that's totally another piece of it all. I sometimes wonder with these sort of things though too, if the justice system actually did what it was supposed to do, kind of thing. If it was easier for someone to go through sort of prosecution of these crimes, would people do it then?
So, well, what's the alternative to prisons? Do you just open the gates, let them roam free?
Yes, Ben.
Yeah, okay.
Let's bust them out. It's done. obviously that seems unlikely. Yeah, I mean, I think we've already touched on some things that are happening that not, I guess what I would say, the mainstream person would probably not necessarily know about, you know, victim offender conferences, rural mediation techniques. There is a lot going on in terms of the restorative justice world these days.
What's restorative justice?
Oh, goodness. Read Howard Zaire's book, The Little Book of Restorative Justice. But basically, restorative justice is focused much more on, like, needs, on victims' needs especially, and how you can reach some sort of point of justice without it being a zero-sum game. And so it has a lot to do, I'm trying to remember too, a lot of restorative justice, yeah, practices have to do with sort of like conferencing, having dialogues, potentially like people doing, giving reparations of some sort, whether that be monetary or like community service, maybe things like that. The idea is to give something back, potentially. But I don't know, I feel like I'm describing this really poorly.
No, it's really so interesting.
Just check out that book though.
It's yeah,
really,
cool.
Really, really the short book, but sweet.
I'll put it in the show notes.
Cool, that'd be great.
Speaking of books, a little birdie, by which I mean you, told me you're writing one.
Oh yeah. yeah, I have been in the process of writing a book for a while.
That's so cool.
Yeah, yeah, I do like it, but it is also like pretty monstrous task to write a book. But yeah, so the book is based on a bunch of oral history interviews that I and my professor Keith Farrington conducted in Walla Walla, Washington, with some of the first women who were correctional officers and staff, which means educators, counselors, people who worked in like administrative sort of roles. So talking with lots of different women about their sort of histories and involvement with the Washington State Penitentiary, which is an all-male maximum security prison. So yeah, the book is a lot, it's both a history and a sociological text in that, you know, we do bring in and incorporate like a number of important concepts, which I will not go into at the moment, but you know, then also like I wrote a whole section of the book about the women's prison that actually was also located on the penitentiary grounds for almost a century of the existence of this penitentiary complex. And it has really been glossed over in a lot of the previous writings about the penitentiary. And so because we're sort of doing this piece that's all about, you know, where did women fit into this world at an all-male penitentiary, if at all? And we find in many cases that, you know, there have been women associated with in and on the walls of the penitentiary from the very day it opened.
Really?
The first women prisoner showed up with all the other men on the first day that the penitentiary was open.
So why is that silenced? Because I guess when we think of, when I think of the archetypal prison, you know, it does have all this class and racial kind of overlays. Mm-hmm. But it's also masculine. I guess, like, you know, things like orange is the new black might be shifting that a little bit. Like, why is it? Why is that history of women's incarceration silenced? Was it? Is there a lot less of it? I suppose, maybe, but also, why is it? Yeah, just
I mean, maybe for many reasons. Like, first, if you can get people interested at all in the history of, like, prisons in general. But, like, I mean, another thing is that women weren't supposed to be criminals. I feel like it was another big kind of issue, maybe, that it has to do with that gender dynamic, right? Like, for one of the things that the women that I interviewed would tell me is for a woman to go to prison in that era, she had to be really bad, right? Because they didn't do any, they could, you know, they had tried all the other things that they could do with her, and then finally they sent her to prison, kind of thing. But it's funny because then you go and you look at, like, the types of, you know, crimes they were committing, and, like, one is, like, you know, a lot of them are, like, writing bad checks or, you know, prostitution, like, things like that, where you're like, oh yeah, you're really bad. Okay, I mean, I don't mean to mock this necessarily, but I'm just kind of like, there is a difference in terms of, like, gender and criminality, and, like, what does that mean? And I think another thing is too, like, if you think of a prison, right, yeah, you're gonna think of, like, this, like, tough lockdown, you know, hyper-masculine sort of thing. Well, if you, like, add women and any sort of gender diversity into that, people are like, oh, what? Like, for example, I mean, for forever in prisons, there's been great diversity in terms of, like, prison queens. There are, like, people who identify as women that have been incarcerated as in male prisons and whatnot. And so that's another thing. You know, we didn't end up writing about it in the book, but it's just, gender is so much more, like, fluid and, you know, not easy to grasp as than people think. Even in a place that is, like, as locked down and sort of rigid as a prison environment. Yeah, I don't think I'm giving the greatest explanation as to, you know, why weren't these women's prisons written about and whatnot. But, I mean, I just think that it goes to show that, like, women criminals criminals in general are kind of ignored, but especially women criminals, because it's like, you know, what are they doing there, and who wants to know about those terrible women that kind of existed back then. But I think it's particularly interesting that was a part of the penitentiary's history, you know. And so we sort of included a section about that, but, you know, also we wrote about a lot of other things in terms of dynamics, I would say, of working in a prison organization. Because a lot of the book, too...
What was that like? Sorry, no, I'm just interrupting you.
I don't know if I remember what I was going to say. Oh, yeah, I think I do, actually. Like, a lot of the book too ends up focusing sort of on occupational cultures, because we are focusing on the people who worked in the prisons, so we end up, like, focusing a lot on the prisons as a gendered organization and how working within a gendered organization sort of functions, and how that also interacts, though, with this being a hyper-masculine prison environment. So, you know, there are many organizations that are what you would call a gendered organization, which basically just means that you have a lot of policies and systems and stuff in place that are based on an imagined male worker.
Yeah.
So when they're conceived, the even if this is not necessarily intentional, though a lot of times it was, like, the ideal worker was a male worker, right? And so, that's what I'm talking about when I'm I'm saying like a gender organization. Yes. Yeah, and so we talk about that, and then, yeah, how does that interact, too, with the fact that this is not a normal work environment, right? Like, this is not, like, there's, say, firefighters, that's, or the military. These are places where you can see gendered sort of work environments, especially for women going into them, but it's... I mean, to me, it's pretty unique to add on top of that the sort of dynamics that you get in a prison and what that's like. So, anyways, that is the book.
Cool. And what's the impact on workers? Because this is sort of this project society's undertaken to concentrate all of this badness, I got air quotes, and all of this kind of broiling trauma, and also these express policies of dehumanization.
Yeah.
What's the toll on the people on the front lines of that, and what kind of support's in place?
Yeah. So it's, I mean, it's huge, and I'm actually really glad that I became involved in work on the side of correctional officers and staff, because I think before I only really cared about, like, oh, people who are incarcerated, it's so unjust, is like kind of how I began all of this. But through the, you know, knowledge and wisdom of my professor who has been doing this work for many years, I feel very fortunate to have gotten into the side of, those who work what I would call beyond the bars but behind the walls. And I think that these people are all part of the system as well. You know, like, it's very easy, I think, sometimes to blame police officers, right, or correctional officers, or the people who work in detention centers, right, as just, like, these horrible, no good, you know, violent people, because there's a lot of violence, you know, that can be committed by these people as well. But, I mean, I also tend to think of them as sort of products of a system. The system is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. Prisons are doing exactly what they were made to do. And you know, if you look at something like the Stanford prison experiment, things like that, I mean, it is so arbitrary and easy for people to sort of use power and power dynamics in the way that they're sort of like told they're supposed to work. I continue to be very interested also in like talking with anyone who is in the system. So that includes correctional officers or people who work within prisons, or, you know, who work as parole, you know, in community corrections, or just all along the line, because it's very interesting to get both sides of the story.
Because I know that I'll regret it if I don't ask you this.
What?
The Zapatistas, you mentioned that you were involved in the Zapatistas. How did this happen? What?
Yeah.
Who are they? What? Just super quickly, sorry.
Yeah, okay, I'll summarize. Yeah, I went to Mexico for 4 months this last year and ended up being in Chiapas. And because I'm always restless and interested in like what's going on in a place, ended up having some conversations that were very, you know, life-changing with some people, and sort of found out about the Zapatista movement.
So for those who don't know, what is the Zapatista movement?
The Zapatista movement was a movement, I guess, that formally began in the early 90s. Where it was basically an indigenous-led movement in the area of primarily Chiapas, Mexico, where a lot of basically like landless, they were basically like indentured workers, is what I would call it. I'm not quite sure. You could say slavery, indentured workers. I mean, it was terrible, terrible working condition. Basically on these sort of like plantation style properties where, so you had, you know, these jefes or bosses running these huge sort of plantation, and had so many indigenous people in these cycles of, you know, it reminded me a lot of like U.S. slavery actually, but just cycles of like debt and violence that they would like kill people, and you know, no one would account for those deaths. I mean, it was basically almost like permissible. Yeah, yeah. And so anyways, this was a massive uprising that happened in, I think it was 1992, I want to say, but I could be wrong, where basically these people rose up and drove those wealthy landowners out off the land and took the land back. And since then, they had actually been training in secret for a while, as so they were trained militarily, but it ended up being a relatively like peaceful like actually takeover at the beginning. But from there, it, you know, of course the government was not going to allow like this to yeah. happen, and so then, you know, then there was a lot of violence and fighting sort of that took place within the next number of years. So my involvement with the sort of Zapatista movement was doing what they called Brigadas de Observación, which is an observation brigade, which is where you have international people who go out into some of the communities who have asked for international like onlookers to be in that community, because generally it helps to prevent violence from happening in that community.
Violence from the state or
within? Violence actually from not only the state but within communities. Yes. So the place that I was actually in particular had a huge rift in the community, in terms of like you had half of the area was Zapatista and half was non-Zapatista, and there had been a pretty violent murder that took place on the part of the non-Zapatista community of a Zapatista member. And so we were there, you know, not only to prevent state violence, but also, I mean, you've got paramilitary and basically people who are being influenced too, I think, by the state and their own like community dynamics and things like that. But there is violence that also comes from within like sort of these communities and stuff. So but the thing is that if you have someone there who is watching, especially someone like international, the idea is that there will be much more of an uproar, because the state does commit, there's a lot of violence committed by the state and by like in maybe a small community that it would just happen and go unnoticed.
Yeah, of course.
And or be covered up. And so the idea is that if you have people from different countries, and especially like some pretty privileged people, like
yeah.
for example myself, like if there was some sort of violence that occurred against those international observers, there would be major, major repercussions. And it's sort of unfortunate to talk about this, because this is, you know, it's politics of it's whose lives matter kind of things, yeah. too, yeah. because it's like, if me as a little white American is down in the Zapatista community and gets murdered, that's going to get a hell of a lot more press than if a Zapatista member dies in yeah. the midst of their community. And that's the way that our, you know, that media coverage works, unfortunately. And so that was what I was doing there. But I also had the opportunity to read a lot about the justice systems and learn a lot about how sort of Zapatista communities are working. And I would say one of the main things that I feel like I was struck by is just gosh, I was struck by so many things, but just the fact that these communities are sovereign, self-determining communities. And so when I'm saying that, I'm saying they have their own transportation system. They have their own, like, power that they're trying to do sustainable, like, energy that is, you know, not provided by the government. They're have their own education system, their own justice system, their own, you know, governmental sort of structures. So they really have an all, they have their own health system.
Wow.
It's really an all-encompassing sort of way of living without the Mexican government. At this point, it's sort of reached this point of, I mean, this has been decades now, where these people have been resisting and still occupying the land and you know, evolving a lot in terms of, like, all of those systems that I just mentioned to you. Those have been built up over the last, like, basically 25 years. And so, but the state, it's still this weird sort of what they call low intensity warfare that's being waged upon the Zapatistas. The thing about the Zapatista community is they've done a really good job of having international recognition, and so the state in some ways is not able to commit the violence that it probably would have, because the Zapatistas have wielded media in such a powerful way, getting people from many different countries involved, getting people, like, to come out to the movement, like, basically what I did is a part of that. And so at this point there's not much happening on the way of, like, direct, like, warfare, but there's definitely, like, a huge military presence in Chiapas, that they're constantly, like, driving by in their, like, military trucks and encampments. Yeah, and every once in a while you'll get a flare-up kind of like, actual, you know, fighting and violence and whatnot. And so, but it's an amazing struggle in the terms of, like, the conditions from which it arose were absolutely horrendous and definitely merited, in my mind, like, I mean, there should have been some sort of intervention, but, like, the people, you know, did that. And then now that this movement has been strong for decades, and it was incredibly inspiring to me in the sense that, like, this movement is still alive and strong and, like, better than ever, I guess I would say, in terms of, like, organizationally now, all of these different things have been able to be built out of the movement, and you have these communities that I feel like are based on something that I actually believe in. And, like, their form of, like, I guess you could call it pure democracy or something like that, but basically, like, everyone is going to have a carga at some point in their life, in a Zapatista community, which means your burden, and your burden is a position in the government, kind of thing.
Wow.
And so everyone will have this, and I would ask people, I was like, okay, so is that good? And they would be like, well, no one really looks forward to their carga because it's a very difficult thing to take on. But because everyone in this community at some point in their life will bear that responsibility of leadership, then everyone, you know, everyone is taking part, right, in continuing these different systems. And
incredible. So rather than a model of power as being something to aspire to and monopolize for, even when not explicitly personal gain, because no one likes to talk about that part, but still as a way to stamp your vision of society onto the world and have influence, even if it's, you know, under a kind of believing benevolence,
right?
Which, let's be honest, is mostly not, right? But rather than that, it's like a, it's a duty and a heavy duty to the community and the collective. That's incredible.
Yeah, no, it is incredible. And I would say, I mean, ever since I read about more about that and then got involved sort of in more in the movement, I mean, my views have been drastically changed on what is possible, I think. In terms of, like, I found it really inspiring, but also, yeah, like, you've got this massive movement happening, at least for me, under, like, the tip of your nose, because I feel like Americans should all know about this, in the sense that, like, this is thousands and thousands of people who have actively been resisting and, like, sovereign from the clutches of, like, the Mexican government in the way that they want to be for, like, the last, like, 25 years.
And without, like, another state structure immediately filling the vacuum.
Yeah, totally. And, yeah, and it's just incredible the way that they go about things. And, yeah, so I thought it was really
inspiring. So cool. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, everyone should learn about the Zapatista movement. Definitely, if you don't already know.
So what's your takeaway? What message do you have for the three or four listeners of Ben's Blaming?
For the people.
The people. The masses.
Gosh, I don't have a message necessarily, but I do think that, like, one thing that I'm constantly struck by, and I don't know if this is just, like, a personal kind of passion of mine or something, but, like, everything that I've done in life for the last, like, 5 years, and, like, most of the conversations that I've had surrounding justice, equity, and all of these, like, things that we strive for can ultimately come back to carceral systems, I guess, is what I'm always struck by. I mean, I feel like you can talk about literally anything. Like, you could talk about education, gender, race, you know, history and colonialism. Like, I could go on and on. And to me, like, this all ends up being connected to, like, where we are today. And what do you do with these, like, quote-unquote worst of the worst people?
Yeah.
Like, and, yeah, I don't know. It's, I think it's also, like, kind of going back to this quote, but it's, like, really important to look at what societies and what different countries are doing with these people who are often considered, like, the lowest, like, dregs of humanity and whatnot, because I personally think, yeah, that you can, like, judge a lot in terms of just the social being of a country or a place or even the world, as I'm looking at now, based on what's happening sort of in different carceral systems and across carceral systems and societies and whatnot. So,
and I guess as we're seeing the rise of the surveillance state, and we're also seeing the kind of resurrection of authoritarianism in a lot of, not that it's ever really gone, but kind of a different flavor of it, and more of these punitive power hierarchies and systems of violence, that it's a very telling metaphor.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. If you want to know something about a place, look at its justice system. So.
Thank you so much, Molly.
Mm-hmm. No problem. Thank you for having me on.
That was so awesome. Thank you so much. I hope your tour goes well. It's so cool. I can't wait to read your book.
Yay. Yeah, thank you. You'll be, like, one of four. Just like your podcast now. Come on.
Just kidding. Book. A real book.
A real live book. yeah, I mean, hopefully it will be read by a few people.
There's not, unfortunately, a sign-off thing. There's no...
There's no welkie-welkie.
There's no equivalent.
G'day, g'day.
G'day, g'day, yes. Like, I love the way you said that. It normally means hello, but... Can you say it again?
G'day, g'day.
Another huge shout out to Marley Rabel for this fantastic conversation. Please listen to her phenomenal podcast, Carceral Complex, and check out some of her writing online. Also, massive props to Mitchell Pasman for this amazing music. Thank you so much. You can find his incredible sound design at skeletonesound.com. That's like skeleton with an E because it's a tone. Very clever. He's a very clever young man. Thank you. And also massive thanks to Andrew Oliver for providing the mic. Thank you so much, Canada. Oh, that's his nickname, Canada. It's a long story. Thank you, Andrew. You can find him just around the town, and he is a solid bloke. Thank you all for listening and for giving me so much encouragement. And I want to give a special thanks to Michael and Duncan for really encouraging me to get back on the old pod wagon. Thank you so much, and peace out. See you soon.